Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review, and you can always visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, or follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching MedTech Money on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. MedTech Money is an interview-style podcast focused on demystifying raising and investing capital for medtech startups. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Galen Data. Galen Data is the cloud for medical device makers. The Galen Cloud provides a configurable platform for device-to-cloud connectivity that is compliant to FDA, HIPAA, and CE mark standards. Built on 40-plus years of collective experience developing compliance systems in the medical device industry, the company's goal is to make medical device cloud connectivity available to all at a fraction of the cost while shaving months off the development timeline. In this episode, our guest Shay Poliker and I discuss the incubator he is running in Israel, his past experience as an entrepreneur, the partners they work with, helping companies get to a fundable milestone, what kind of companies this is open to from a geographical perspective, what type of medtech companies they look for, your window of opportunity, the importance of communication, what makes the Israeli ecosystem so great, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Shay Poliker.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Shay, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. Before we jump too far into it, just a brief intro into who you are and what you do would be great.
An engineer background, and but over the last 20 years I've been developing medical devices in various indications, and most recently in the last 4 or 5 years I've been running a medical device incubator in Israel called the MedX Accelerator, in which we invest in medical device ventures. And I can use my past experience as an entrepreneur and as an operation person to try to and help those ventures be as successful as possible.
Yeah. So you're in the specific region of Israel. You're in Tel Aviv, I take it.
In the general Tel Aviv area. Yes, just outside.
Okay. Very good. Tel Aviv. Yep. Okay. And your engineering background, is that in biomedical engineering, mechanical, or is it just engineering as a whole there?
So I studied electrical engineering in Israel in the okay. Tehran, and I have an MBA from in the US from Columbia University in New York.
Oh, very nice. Have you always been in med tech, or did you start in another industry and then kind of transition over?
Almost always in medtech. I did spend maybe a couple of years doing signal processing and software writing for other applications, but this was a very short episode. I can hardly remember.
Very good. All right. So tell me about the MedX Accelerator. What you're doing, what makes you unique. You started this, what did you say, 5 years ago?
Yeah, we started just about 5 years ago. We've been investing for the last just over 4 years. We did our first investment in March 2018, so more or less 4 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. We've done 12 investments so far. We are focused on medical devices and digital health. Early stage, as early as you can find those ideas. Our partners are Boston Scientific, which I'm sure you know, the Sheba Medical Center. It's the biggest hospital in Israel. Actually, I think it's the biggest in the Middle East.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a very large medical center. And two financial investors, Consensus Business Group from the UK and MedX Ventures, which is a fund doing medical robotics. And we are working under a license from the Israeli government, from the Israeli Innovation Authority, which basically joins every investment we make. So every time we make an investment in a new venture, there is a grant that comes along with it. And altogether, the companies are getting around $1 million, just around $1 million, for a period of about 2 years, during which we are not just investors, we are also part of the development of the company. They work within our offices, within the incubator offices, in our labs, and we are day in, day out, we are jointly supporting them, allowing them to be very capital efficient and reach their milestones as quickly as possible, and then raise the next round of funding. As you can imagine, $1 million is hardly enough to, you know, to usually to get to commercialization in medical devices, but it can be enough to reach a fundable milestone if you have a significant infrastructure around you with just one or two people and a large network of, you know, 10, 15, 20 people surrounding you.
I mean, that's key, right? Getting to a fundable milestone. I think that's, you know, when you look at the road to product development and how long it's going to take, right? I think it could be daunting when you look at it and think about, oh, we have to raise all this money to, you know, get it into the hospitals or wherever you're trying to sell it. But a fundable milestone, I think, is key. So I'm glad you brought that up. So about $1 million for each company. It's nice that you're not only giving them the cash, but also the services. I want to kind of talk about a little bit about the services as well. But with that, so is it like a 50-50 split? Is the money that comes from the Israeli government, does that have any stipulations? Do they have to, you know, stay in Israel or produce so many jobs? Or is it just kind of like, we just want to promote innovation, so there's no stipulations?
So all good questions. It's actually better than 50-50. It's about 80% coming from the government and only 20% from our fund, which is a major leverage. The whole idea is to support and encourage experienced investors and companies like Boston Scientific to tap in early on in ventures, which is not, you know, this is something that is not always, that doesn't always happen. So that's one side. And in terms of the requirements are pretty mild. The main motivation from both the incubator and the Israeli Innovation Authority actually is to make the company successful. So they don't have a limitation on if they need to do a research in outside of Israel or they need to hire somebody outside of Israel. There are no limitations like that. There are some, I would say, restrictions on how much you can pay employees for the duration of the incubator, but these are relatively small, and we try to get over those, but by adding additional funding from the incubator itself, from the partners, beyond what we are required for the matching. So there is some kind of an additional money that allows us some flexibility. So I would say that this is not really limiting in any meaningful way. There is a requirement that the IP is supposed to stay in Israel for the duration of the company's life, but you can buy out from that requirement, and these are all reasonable terms. Overall, these are not restrictions that would drive entrepreneurs away from the program, even those that are coming outside of Israel. And there are also no limitations on incubating kind of out of Israel ideas, projects, patents, and all that.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Okay, so this program is open to people all over the world, technically.
Yes, there could be a foreign entrepreneurs. And definitely foreign investors can join in. Our first company was purchased right out of the incubator by a large Chinese fund. And they remain in Israel, but the shareholders are now 100% foreign.
Cool.
And this really has there's no problem with the Innovation Authority.
Yeah, so this is truly falling under that smart money side of things, right? Like we talk about that with early entrepreneurs quite a bit, is when they're raising their first chunk of money, it's like there's smart money, there's neutral money, and then there's bad money. This is smart money, right?
I've seen all of those.
Yeah, right. So very cool. So from a service standpoint, you know, what what kind of services talent do you have in-house? I mean, everything from product development through regulatory support, or what does that kind of look like?
Yeah, basically, we can provide to the venture everything that it would need, except obviously what we require is a very strong clinical unmet need. Once you have that, even if the technological solution is not complete, this is something we can support. So the network, which means the incubator team that are on the ground in Tel Aviv, as well as the networks that are external from our partners, from our collaborators, they provide everything that the venture would need, from R&D support, from various multidisciplinary areas, through, as you mentioned, regulatory, clinical trial design and execution, IP, both the licensing part and the writing and defending part, all the legal, administrative, financial elements. So the companies, our CFO, the incubator CFO, is the CFO of all the incubator companies. Administration, they have office space, lab space, and the basic equipment they would get as part of the incubator. And if they need anything specific, they would buy from their own budget. And then I would add to that, really, we leverage the power of our partners and collaborators. First and foremost is Boston Scientific, which it's a strong powerhouse of innovation and R&D, commercialization and business support, and also the Sheba Medical Center, which is also, they have a very wide variety of clinical expertise. And again, also our financial partners, they have their own very wide network of from their side. And it's almost, it doesn't happen that we need to get to some expert or to some potential partner and we are not able to find some contact there. And there is a clinical, I would say, multidisciplinary clinical network all over the world. It could be, Europe, US, even Latin America and Asia. We are pretty well connected. And if we don't know the right person, we can get them to them through some contact. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to comment on this because it's something that oftentimes I think is undervalued by startup companies. Mm-hmm. The power of meeting someone who has a large network and will admit right off the bat that they don't know everything, but they know someone who does, is crucial for these startups to just get to the right answers, whether it's at the beginning when you're trying to evaluate your market size and you're trying to talk to different key opinion leaders and get a feel for whether it's a good idea or not. Those types of conversations to have someone who has a big network is key, right? But then once you get going and you start to, are making business decisions and trying to sculpt where you're going to take the company, to be able to have someone who doesn't tell you they know the answer, but will admittedly say, I don't know that answer, but I know who does, and get that answer for you, it's crucial. I think admittedly, when I first came into the industry, I really undervalued that, and then kind of saw the power of it. So it's there's some accelerators that tell you they have these connections and they don't. And some of these startups fall victim to that, right? But it's nice when you can confidently say, oh yeah, we do have that. We can introduce to those people. So I think that's a pretty big feature you're offering them.
Yeah, generally speaking, we would not invest in a venture if we didn't have before that a very serious discussion with a potential strategic partner in that field that is very active in this commercial area, in that space, and heard from them feedback, not about the solution necessarily, because this could still be a trade secret and maybe not patented enough, but about the need. I want to hear from either Boston Scientific or from another collaborator, one of the large players in that space, that if we buy this, they would be able to sell it. And there is a true commercial need and a willingness to pay for that solution. Otherwise, it's very scary to get into that into those spaces. And if we cannot get the strategic partner to support it, frankly, we would just stay away.
Yeah, there's it's crazy. I mean, there's a lot to commercialization. I lump reimbursement in with commercialization. And I just read a post today on LinkedIn where someone was reminiscing on their first startup company, and they went through the entire PMA process in the United States for a medical device. And then when they got to the end, they realized that they had never considered reimbursement and it wasn't payable. And you're just like, you know, your head hurts looking at that. But so many people miss this. They think that, well, yeah, if I'm inventing this, there must be a problem, but they actually end up, they're creating a problem in their head. And that's an issue. So that's a good, good part that you're supporting in is really helping determine the commercial need for this, and being able to talk to those strategics in a big hospital system. It's crucial, right? You can't undervalue that.
And you mentioned reimbursement. So one of the major points there that we always try to find, of course, if we find the right code and the right payment, that's great. Always great to have. But we, in general, we'd always look for the value-based healthcare angle, if there is one. And we think that this is where the market is going. It doesn't cover, you know, the whole universe of medical devices for sure, but there are some areas like in surgery, orthopedics, others, where there is definitely a room for innovation that can fit into value-based healthcare. And then if you do that, you are in a very good position going forward. That you don't have to worry about creating a new code. That's one of the things I'm trying to stay away from, is having to do something like that.
Yeah, we just went to, we were speaking at a conference, this would have been in March, the end of March, and it was all about, you know, value-based care. And then you start talking about that so much, and especially in the United States, there is a lot of what we call middlemen, you know, within the healthcare system that add zero value to healthcare, but are taking a chunk of money from it. And we spent a lot of time talking about that, but there's a lot of people who are talking about value-based care, and it's coming. It's just, when is it coming? Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a good point. It's a good way to evaluate technology as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's not just during the evaluation and the due diligence. Once, even after the company is invested in and is incubated, and the team usually is very focused on developing the product, you know, doing the first bench test, animal test, then the clinical trial. It's very easy to lose sight on, you know, the changing market environment. And things change. One example I can give you is one of our companies in the dialysis space. And we invested in that company in late 2018. If you look at the dialysis market, it's a company that does monitoring for dialysis patients. If you look at the market then, in 2018, if you look at it today, it's a completely, in the US specifically, the landscape is completely changing now. And there is a significant integration into companies taking a larger and growing part of the risk of the patients. And there is much more room for remote patient monitoring. I mean, Corona changed everything in that respect as well. But even without that, there are important changes that makes reimbursement and payment and value-based care very different than what they used to be just 3-4 years ago. So you have to keep your eyes on the ball there, you know, because you can find, when you get commercial, you can find a completely different space than what you when you just entered.
Oh yeah, we always compare it to like if you when we talk about some of these early like engineers and physicians, it's hey, there's a window, and your window of opportunity opens and closes, and unfortunately, you're not the deciding factor of when the window gets opened and closed. I mean, you might influence a little bit, but someone else is doing that for you. And you know, there's a lot of when people are tinkering with their device, I always tell them, like, go be a historian of the problem, because you might find that someone tried to solve this problem 30 years ago with your solution, and they just weren't ready for it. Right. And maybe now's the time again. Right. So just be aware of those things, and things can change. I mean, you could, you know, you might start out on this journey, you get approval, and it's 3 years. And like you just said, right, the market looks totally different. So I think that's really good advice for them. You spend a lot of time around startups, right? So I'd love to know a little bit about, you know, what are some of the common errors you see? And then, so common errors, and then after you kind of talk about those, like those, you know, gotcha moments, maybe what are the things that you're like, hey, this, for a successful company, you have to have these three ingredients, right? Or, you know, whatever it might be. So start negative and then move positive.
So I think that the most typical, I would say, issue or mistake that you see, and I think you see that a lot in Israel as well, because there are very good engineers here, and they sometimes tend to focus on the solutions and not so much on what they are trying to solve. And we see amazing technologies, and then they are not really married to the right clinical unmet need, even if there is one. It's sometimes non-trivial. In many cases, it's not a trivial decision on, you know, where to start. If you have a platform technology, what is the first indication that you are going after? And this is usually where we see the mistakes. I think one of the difference between our incubator and, I would say, your typical investor is that when an experienced investor sees a solution that does not address the right problem or address the wrong problem, they would just say, okay, this is not for me. What we are trying to do is to find those, and if we can fix them, if we can, you know, if they have the wrong solution for the right problem or the wrong problem for the right solution, we try to kind of adjust this. And if the entrepreneurs are open to constructive criticism and advice, then we would walk with them. And sometimes you could see during our 6 months of due diligence that the team would write a new patent. They would completely change the indications. Sometimes they will add a very important part of the solution. We do have a company where they pitch to us. We explain to them about some major issue that is not covered by their solution. They went back. They thought about this for 6 months. They came back with a solution, and they got into the incubator. In many cases, we do it with them. We are happy to do it with them, and then we also do that, as a kind of a free advice and mentoring for entrepreneurs. So that I think is probably the number one things that we see for people coming over and get rejection. We do, you know, about 150 to 200 of those that are coming over. Out of each one that we invest in, we end up saying no to about, you know, 150 to 200. So it's quite a few that didn't really find the real unmet need or trying to do a me too. The second thing that I would have to stress, because we see that a lot, especially in, you know, the very fashionable digital health space, is lack of a clear business model. You find a very exciting source of data and some potential, let's say, prevention or monitoring that you really fits very well, but it's not clear who is going to pay for that. How do you create real value? And that's something, this is where we typically, if we don't see the business model, we just pass.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Those, it's starting. I mean, you know, we've done 88 episodes, and we have another 6 records. So like, this is like 95 ish or something like that. And then we have a whole nother series that has like 70 some interviews. These are starting, we're starting to see common trends in errors like this. Right. And this is those two you just highlighted are 100%, some of the common ones we see. So, that makes a lot of sense. What about, and this is where we get a lot of, we get overlap, but we also get unique ones. What about key ingredients and like the recipe for success?
So what we are trying to, what we are looking for, and if we don't see that, we try to add it to the mix, is the diversity of the team. And in our field, this is typically the right combination, the magical combination is a physician and an engineer that can communicate. And each of them knows a little bit of the language, you know, a few words of the other person's, language. And then really, real magic can happen. Mm-hmm. And an important part of what we do, we have this a program called Explore. When we are talking to hospitals, to physicians that have problems with that solution, major clinical unmet need. And they sometimes have these very general, vague solutions that they have in their mind, but they don't have the engineering capability or knowledge to solve it. But they can start the direction towards a solution. All you need to do sometimes is add to them a good engineer, good experienced engineer, put them in the same room together, throw some ideas to them. And again, magic happens. And that's, we have today about 20-30% of our deal flow coming from such combinations. And we love this deal flow because there is no competition. This is something that is created in the office of the incubator. Before that, it just didn't exist. So we do that with hospitals. We try, and we do that sometimes with our partners. With Boston Scientific, we have a program like that. With other collaborators, we started working with West Pharma, who is in the area of drug device combination, wearable injectables. And we are working with their clinical unmet need, where they see the market needs going forward, and trying to marry solution, technological solutions to those clinical unmet needs. And this really creates some nice projects. As I mentioned, this is an important part today of our deal flow, and it's unique and it's very exciting. And you know there will be somebody waiting for that on the other side of the incubator when you do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's perfect. And also a key word to highlight, you said a physician and an engineer that can communicate, right? And communication is so crucial. And oftentimes overlooked. I mean, not only do you start to run in from a communication standpoint, like when I talk about communication, a lot of people are like, oh, do you mean like language to language? And it's like, well, that, but no, what I mean is that like the physician communicating with the engineer, I don't care if it's in English or German or whatever it's in, right? I mean, it's still that kind of merger, right? We always talk about marketing and engineering talking and speaking the same language and that kind of thing. So communication is crucial, absolutely crucial.
Yeah, and
so
I'm glad you brought that up. Part of that communication is each of them knowing their own limits, their own circle of competence. You know, a smart person said that it's more important to know the limits of your competence than to actually have a wide one. So if the physician knows when his knowledge ends and where the engineer can help him, and the other way around, I think this is crucial for success.
We talk to a lot of early entrepreneurs, and they are so protective over equity, right? They're mm-hmm. very protective. We don't want to give up. You know, I can only lose 80. I can only use 20%. I want to keep 80. And you know, they have all these stipulations they put in place, and I'll always push back and say, why is that in place? Like what, where are you getting that in the math from? And why is that so important to you? And like, well, if we exit, I want this much. And they have all these different reasons and none of them are good in my opinion. You know, I always push back to them and just say, look, 100% equity of something that's worth nothing is nothing. 10% of equity of something that's worth 100 million is 10 million, right? I mean, that's just easy math for them to understand. That's like, you know, you have to have a team, and I've yet to meet someone who is that talented in all those areas. I'm sure there's some outliers, right? That can do everything themselves. But I totally agree with you. Check the ego at the door, understand what you're good at and do what you're good at and have a supporting team. And you want them to buy in anyways. I just, you know, it's a weird thing for me that I'm not sure I completely understand the mindset behind yet. So I guess I have to keep reading. actually, I got to keep reading the books. They're from Israel, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a lot of their books. Actually, I have a lot of Danny Kahneman's new books sitting at the top of my shelf I need to read. Awesome. Is there anything else in terms of that success model that, you know, you look for besides that communication team?
Again, this is it's part of the same thing. It's just the openness to accepting things that that you don't know, and I think that would help them. And what you mentioned about the value, it does take a little bit of experience, and we try to explain, you know, the if you do a good job in those first 2 years of the incubator, what you are avoiding is this massive dilution that happens if you in your Series A round, if you are even able to do that. And that's the difference between, you've said it yourself, is the difference between, you know, giving up, you know, having 100% of nothing, or, you know, a bigger portion, a smaller portion of an important value. It's almost meaningless, the amount of equity that you hold in the beginning. The value that you create as you go along, that really is something that remains with you.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's the conversations happen all the time. You know, we talk about that constantly at the Project MedTech side of things is, you know, people are like, oh, so you must own this much equity. And I'm always like, equity means nothing until we have a liquid event. Equity doesn't mean anything. It just doesn't. I mean, you could write up an operating agreement of a company, and you could hold 5% equity and still hold all the voting power if you wanted to, right? Like it doesn't correlate to anything. And I think that's what sometimes people don't understand, but, okay, very good. I want to talk a little bit about, your experience with Israel as well, right? So I ask every guest that comes on, that's from Israel, because, and people are probably sick of me saying this by now, but, you know, there are certain countries, that you expect to be very innovative because of how many people they have, right? It's just, you know, the more people you'd expect, oh, the more innovation, right? And then there's countries like Israel that punch way above their weight class, right? I think there's 8 million people in Israel, or nine, somewhere in there.
I think it's around nine now.
Nine, yeah. So there's 9 million people, and there is so much innovation that comes out of Israel, and is also, I believe, at this point, staying in Israel, right? I mean, the companies are actually not just startups and then selling off. They're staying, they're growing, they're commercializing. So anyways, I was trying to look through the list, and I'm definitely missing some, but we've had Tamir Marie on from Johnson & Johnson Venture Investment Arm. We've had Yuri Geiger on from Accelamed. Yeah. We've had Veer Cohen on from Memic, Eyal Lifshitz from Peregrine Ventures, Yoav Fisher. We've had the people on from Amoon. I mean, it's insane that we just go down this list, and there's some I know that I'm missing, and they're all from Israel or in the Israel community. And so I always ask them.
Some of them are my next door neighbors, actually.
Yeah, that's right. We talked about
this. Veer and Eyal are really just across the street.
Yeah, yeah. So we talk about this, and it's like, there's some things going on that makes for a really good recipe for innovation, right? And the funny thing is when I've asked all these folks, you know, what makes it so great, everyone's had a different answer and a different spin, which tells me that there's a lot of good stuff going on. So from your perspective, what makes the Israeli ecosystem so it is so rich for innovation, and especially in this health tech space?
Well, I think this is a very, this could be a very long answer. So
go ahead.
And I'm not an expert in that. And I think you have this book Startup Nation that gave a lot of, you know, people have a lot of opinions on that. But I do think that the system in Israel in general does promote innovation. I mean, it's a very, I would say, capitalistic system from one hand that rewards success, and there is competition, positive competition. And on the other hand, you have a very strong social system, very criticized by many, but still I think it's pretty good, even compared to, you know, Western Europe, on the healthcare system and the social system. So it does give you some sense of confidence, of social confidence. Again, I know some people would argue with me, but I do think that there is still a good education system, especially in some of the higher education places. I mean, I've learned in the Technion and in Colombia, I don't know too many universities in the US, but I do think that the Technion plays a very important part in how I think about the problem, even if I don't remember every little detail about, differential equations. There is a way there that teaches you to think on future problems and not just, the exercise you have to solve. But this is all very tricky and hard to define. It's the atmosphere, and I think you mentioned that. The whole environment and the ecosystem drives you to excel. You can get a reward for that. And there is also, people maybe are less afraid to fail. It is this social confidence or security, but it's also an atmosphere in the office and in at least some companies that I know that allows you to throw out stupid ideas and nothing bad will happen, and everybody, and maybe if three people, if you hear three stupid ideas from three people, or maybe ideas that could not work, that would kind of seed the way to the solution that actually would work. And as long as people feel free to speak their mind, this is something that I think contributes a lot to that. And and things that people say in the past, that there is very little hierarchy and very openness, between it's really a meritocracy in most places. You can speak your mind and you can be right and your manager can be wrong, and there is nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I love that. I think the problem solving aspect too, I think that rings really true. So like, I have a master's in medicinal chemistry, right? So it's very technical on the organic chemistry side of things, right? But people always ask like, oh, well, how did you get into what you're doing now? And it's like, my master's degree, the only thing that my thesis tells you is that I was able to solve a complex issue and write about it. And that's the biggest thing I got from it, right? It's not the skills in chemistry or what happens, when you switch out the chemical structure or anything like that. It's the fact that I learned how to solve a problem, and I can apply that in the future, right? And so I love that concept of learning how to solve a problem, because that's overlooked now, I think, sometimes, right? In a lot of fields. And so I think that's big. I think that's a good answer. I like that. So I think it's really cool. I just fascinated with just the innovation that comes out of there. Just like when you look at the biggest thing for me was like when I look at population and then how many guests I've had on from different countries, like again, you just expect that some larger countries would have more people in this space, and it's just not the case. It's just not the case. So that's pretty cool. Well, awesome. So, Shai, I think that's everything. Do you have anything else in closing that we missed that you wanted to talk about?
No. First of all, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure. Talking about those things. And I would welcome any one of your listeners to contact us, whether they are entrepreneurs or investors or just interested in medtech.
Yeah,
give us a call. We're happy to hear about good ideas.
Yeah, awesome. So hang on for a minute. We'll chat offline when I stop the recording here. But I will include a link to your LinkedIn page in the show notes. I'll include a link to the website. And that way people can reach out to you either way there. So Shai, I really appreciate your time today. Hang on for 1 minute. And thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.